Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Jacob Zuma ordered to pay back 29 million rand in legal fees, a major ruling with big accountability implications. The Cape Town Marathon fallout, the cancelled race carries a hidden tourism cost. South Africa could face a 17% water shortfall by 2030. And after a WITS cyber attack, the education sector is flagged as one of the most vulnerable targets. It's Thursday, the 23rd of October. Former President Jacob Zuma has been ordered by the Gauteng High Court to repay 28.9 million rand to the state, money that was spent on his legal fees. Joining me now to discuss the implications is Kevin Malunga, former Deputy Public Protector and Academic Head at Regenesis Law School. Kevin, welcome to you. How significant then is the ruling and what kind of precedent does it set?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, to you and the listeners. It's long overdue precedent. In the actual fact, it's how things should work in a society that subscribes to the rule of law, a constitutional democracy such as South Africa, in which in terms of section 9 of the constitution, all are equal before the law and should receive full protection of the law. There was a lot of mischief, and I think the former president's team even concedes to this, the fact that, to the idea of a private citizen being, paid or being a beneficiary of such a largesse or such a large amount of money at state expense. It's an unconscionable. If I can just take you back, Jeremy, and to the listeners, to the mandate of the state attorney. Now, you see, the state attorney is a legal practitioner appointed by the Minister of Justice to represent and protect the interest of the state in civil matters. And of course, there's a very old act, which is the State Attorney Act 56 of 1957. And of course, the office is part of the Department of Justice. And the idea here to defend, withdraw, continue legal proceedings in court on behalf of the state, and even after Jacob Zuma ceased to be president, this was continued, and the blame was given to what. Mr. Zuma's team called constitutional delinquents in the state attorney's office, which is really convenient. So in other words, they're saying, no, we didn't sign up for this. It was the officials who authorized this. So, but these were Mr. Zuma's personal challenges in corruption cases, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea of that, if that would be how a government would run, that would really be unfortunate. So right now, if, for example, you are litigating against the president, Mr. Ramaphosa, or one of his ministers or one of the departments, indeed, that would be an appropriate form of expenditure, especially in their official capacities, what we call ex officio work.
Kevin, let me ask you this yes. Question. The judgment itself, does it signal, in your opinion, real state capacity to recover the funds, or do you think that this is mostly symbolic?
Judge Miller went quite wide. He, if you look at the judgment. He talks about movable, immovable assets, and possibly the presidential pension. And of course, the 29 million can be found under the presidential pension. And I think that's the only place where they're most likely to find it. Because many people have asked about the president, former president, Nkandla Homestead. Mm. And my considered argument is that because that was built under trust land, which is not a mortgage property, I don't think that could be reasonably attached. If you take me back to my old life as Deputy Public Protector, when we investigated the Nkandla project, the idea was that obviously that is not a mortgage property, and truth be told, it really matters. That's a property that's of value mostly to Jacob Zuma himself. I doubt Jeremy Maggs would want that property even for free, even to live in.
Kevin Malunga, let me ask you this. What recourse now does Jacob Zuma have? Because inevitably he's going to come out swinging, isn't he?
He can try and appeal, but you see, the unique vagaries of this particular judgment, Jeremy, is that Judge Miller is actually somewhat enforcing the judgment of a higher court. He refers extensively to the Supreme Court of Appeal. The decision in 2021, where they say the very same thing. So the likelihood of Jacob Zuma, former President Zuma, to respect his title, going to the Supreme Court of Appeal to appeal, which would ordinarily be the natural course, is a highly unlikely, because that's Judge Miller is actually asserting what SCA said, and his history with the Constitutional Court, as you know, is not the most successful.
Yeah, that we know indeed. Kevin Malunga, what message does this send out to other high-profile figures then who might want to use state funds for ostensibly private battles?
I think it just says that era is probably over, because it was a very unique era, Jeremy. Mm. It was almost unprecedented in the sense that people could then just, you know, dig into the state kitty for their own problems, and I think that would, in any sort of constitutional democracy, would set a very bad precedent. You know, if Jeremy Maggs is fighting someone, his neighbor, over a dispute, the state shouldn't get involved in that. That's just the nature of how legal. But if Jeremy Maggs is a minister in government, fighting government and state battles, yes, that is fine. So I don't know if I'm making sense.
You're making sense. And Kevin Malunga, I'm out of time. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Former Deputy Public Protector.
Thank you very
also
much.
Also academic head at the Regenesis Law School.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the cancellation of this past Sunday's Cape Town Marathon has left more than just a few disappointed runners in its wake. It has triggered an economic and reputational aftershock. There's a new study by local research firm Yazi that reveals the cancellation could cost the city something in the region of 15 million rand in lost tourism revenue, while also shaking international confidence in Cape Town's ability to manage large-scale events. The race's bid to join the elite Abbott World Marathon Majors may also have taken a knock. Well, let's pull all of this together. I'm in conversation now with Tim Trigas, who's founder and chief executive of Yazi. Tim, let's start with that headline number, 15 million rand lost in tourism revenue. I suspect it might be a bit more than that. How did you arrive at that figure?
It's rather conservative, and it's obviously based on an assumption of how many people had traveled from outside of the Western Cape. And there's a stat that sort of shows that about 53% of people are not from Cape Town. And so obviously there was 24,000 runners. And so, you know, from that 12,000, we could sort of extrapolate an average of 5 or 10,000 rand. And then actually just to be cautious, we reduced it to 15 million. But obviously, I mean, in our data set, we had around 7% of people were from outside of South Africa, from Kenya, from the US, from Amsterdam and the Netherlands, and from the UK. And then that's, we're predominantly obviously in a South African network, so you could immediately see just from our small study survey, we got a lot of international, which with those flights would have cost a lot of money.
And the fact that so many runners, Tim, were non-local also says a lot about the marathon's importance as a tourism event, doesn't it?
It does. Maybe to highlight one, probably one of the more sad and extreme quotes, or emotive quotes, was someone that said, "I had family from Europe visiting who saved money to do the marathon and prepared for a year to run their first marathon. And they are shattered. I think it'll be very, very difficult to convince foreigners to invest in this event if there's a good chance for it to be cancelled." And that was one Cape Townian who actually wrote that, obviously, about their family.
Your data, if I read this correctly, shows that runners felt the real failure wasn't the weather itself, which was fairly awful anyway, but rather poor planning and probably bad communication. What's your assessment?
Yeah, that's correct. So I think, I mean, just to take a step back, obviously what we saw was that social media was ablaze with obviously quite polarized opinions. So at Yazzie, my research company, we thought, okay, let's actually just try and capture what runners really think, not what is on X and Instagram and Facebook for covering the people that are a bit more vocal. So we launched it on Sunday, sort of by Tuesday morning, we've over 500 responses. And then a lot of what came through was those sort of, as you say, those realities of what people felt. So, I mean, some of those top numbers, like 67% of people said that they actually would have run. Obviously, I think we know now that that wasn't possible, but if they'd been given the option to, you know, considering the safety concerns, they would have chosen to run. And 40% of runners wanted a delayed start. Again, I think we know now that wasn't possible. But in the future, you know, for the Cape Town Marathon Group, I think that's probably an action point for them, is to allow for some malleability around that time. And because perhaps if they had allowed for margin there, they would have been able to delay by a bit. And then, yes, as you say, 20% of people called out communication as a specific failure. And I think there are a couple of people that even, you know, read the first announcement as more related to terrorism than anything weather. So a lot of people were actually quite unnerved by what the reason was without having any understanding.
How damaging do you think the cancellation is then for Cape Town's reputation internationally, particularly among repeat marathon travelers?
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment on beyond this data set too much. It's not my area of expertise, but what I can tell you is we did ask the question of around people coming back, and 49% of people said they are definitely returning in 2026. So, you know, it's pretty positive. And if you think definitely returning was the exact terminology, so that is someone that is committed to running it. A lot of people, I'm sure, aren't sure if they're going to run next year, not because of what happened, but more because they're not sure about running a marathon every year, right? So I think we could sort of project that at least 75-odd% of people definitely weren't impacted by this, you know, going forward, which is good.
I did make the point at the start of our conversation that the event, the race, is vying for World Marathon Major status. It must surely jeopardize that ambition, or do you think people will be more forgiving?
So again, this isn't an area that I think the data set is really going to help speak to. It seems like from all the media announcements that have come following the event, that it actually hasn't impacted Cape Town marathons. The marathon's chances of actually getting into that. But a lot of people did comment and say that I hope they don't, because they really made a big blunder here and they don't deserve it.
So based on the data, and this is a last question to you then, Tim, what does Cape Town need to do, or what lesson has it got to act on if it wants to keep its place on the global marathon map?
I think very practically, this can't happen again. So I think the infrastructure, everything that, you know, caused the issue here around the preparation and setting up windproofing infrastructure is critical. And I think, again, leaving margin for anything to sort of go wrong and for them to have enough time to correct. And then from a comms point of view, to be able to communicate that in a way that actually makes people feel sort of confident in what's taking place and obviously not unnerved by the incidents.
I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Tim Trigas, Founder, Chief Executive Officer of the research firm Yazzi. I do appreciate your time.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
South Africa, I read, could face a 17% water deficit by 2030 if urgent action isn't taken. Now, that is a stark, worrying and disturbing warning from Absa Business Banking sustainability specialist Paige Bowen. Water scarcity isn't just an environmental issue, she says. It's fast becoming a threat to economic stability, food security and business continuity. With 40% of water lost before it reaches you and I, South Africa risks a future of water shedding that could echo the dark days of load shedding. So that's all worrying stuff. Paige joins us now to discuss the risks and hopefully some solutions. Paige, a 17% deficit is a staggering figure. How close are we to some kind of tipping point?
I think as you've painted the picture, it really is quite a dire situation. What I do think it's necessary to say, we are a water scarce country. And obviously I can't say for sure what will happen in the future, but really water is a vital, vital resource. And it's therefore even more pressing that we sort out these constraints than when we did have the electricity crisis. What I can say is government, private sector, all the businesses, I think, are very aware of these challenges. And there is a lot of good work that's being done to see what can be done and what needs to be done collectively so that we can solve for this these water constraints so that we don't land up in a water shedding crisis like we had with load shedding.
Let's talk about what's being done in just a moment, but you compare this then to the early years of load shedding. Are there specific lessons that we could apply now to avoid repeating that crisis?
I think lessons learned from load shedding is really that we need to be proactive in our approach and start planning in advance. So having proper investment in efficient solutions now and then backup solutions will then create an opportunity for businesses to survive and remain operational through a water crisis that may be then influencing them going forward.
Paige, we've got to the point where the private sector, I guess, has got to play an increasing role in plugging these gaps. But one's got to ask if they are stepping up fast enough, if they're actually seeing and experiencing the risk right now.
Definitely, businesses are currently experiencing the risk with water. A lot of the conversations that we are having as Absa with our business clients is that they are looking at investing and are already investing in water efficient or alternative water systems, things like rainwater harvesting, boreholes, and just general treatment systems. So I think it's necessary to say, you know, different industries have different water requirements. Manufacturers, for example, their water need is really immense for production or cooling. Other sectors, maybe retailers, it's simpler, such as sanitation or fire safety compliance. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. But a lot of businesses are already looking at how can they remain operational and what systems can they implement to be water efficient that also then aligns to their overall and overarching sustainability goals.
It's not one size fits all, but for business, is there one single smart investment they could make today to reduce water risk in the short term?
I think the first thing that businesses should be doing is really just understanding and assessing their water risk. From there, then they can implement the various technologies. Being water efficient, so your water recycling, reuse, such as your grey water systems, is a really, really great technology for businesses to be using. But it is also very dependent on the sector. So a lot of manufacturers are looking at that system, whereas your retailers, they're looking more at your rainwater harvesting. It also is, it's costs vary quite widely. So it is dependent on the level of water that the business requires in order to remain operational. But I think being water efficient is the first step that businesses need to take on their overall water journey.
Of course, business might argue that it's not their problem. 40% of water is lost through leaks. It's an infrastructure failure, and that sits firmly on the shoulders of provincial and local government, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's important, you know, water resilience is a multifaceted issue. So there's various issues that or various factors that impact on water availability, such as sort of the ones that you mentioned earlier. And yes, the infrastructure challenges are real, but they are being addressed through collaborative efforts between government, private sector, civil society. So, and I think we can also really draw on Cape Town Day Zero's response to their water crisis that they hit. And that crisis then can be averted by having the correct response. So I think it's businesses can and they really should play a role in supporting these efforts. And as ABSA, our role is to help them do so responsibly and ensuring that their operations are secure, while we also then look to contribute to broader water resilience. So it's really, there's a shared responsibility. I don't think the responsibility lies with any singular party.
Have banks, ABSA included, got to the point where turning water security is now a financing priority rather than just a compliance box to tick?
Very much so, yes. I think businesses, in order to remain operational, are needing to invest in some form of water backup, water resilient type of system. It does also obviously link to ESG or environmental, social and governance practices, where water stewardship is becoming a core pillar to the overarching ESG strategy of businesses to remain competitive and gain access to various markets, both locally and internationally.
And just a final one, what kind of timeline are we really working with before water shedding becomes an unavoidable reality?
I think if we look at it strategically or what we're already experiencing on the ground, we already need to be looking at this. I don't think we have time to waste. I think if we wait until the taps run dry, then it's too late and we need to action and start working on this immediately.
Paige Bowen from ABSA Business Banking, Sustainability Specialist. Thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A major cyber attack on the University of the Witwatersrand's Oracle e-business system has again exposed vulnerabilities in South Africa's education sector. According to Checkpoint Software Technologies, education is now the most targeted industry globally. And listen to this, facing something in the region of 4,000 attempted attacks per institution every week. That is worrying. Well, joining me now is Ian van Rensburg, Head of Security Engineering Africa at Checkpoint. Ian, a very warm welcome. Let's start with the basics then. What exactly happened at WITS, and explain to me why this attack is so significant?
Well, in short, the attack was limited to the Oracle e-business system and was part of a global attack on the Oracle e-business system due to an inherited vulnerability in the software. So this is what we call a zero-day attack. It means the software vendor was not aware of it and there was not a bug fix or what we call a patch available for that environment. But it was not just the University of Witwatersrand. Obviously, that was targeted. There were also others in the world, like the Harvard University, Envoy Air, and also Emerson that was targeted in the world.
Could you explain to me how zero-day threats then differ from typical cyber attacks and why they are so hard to defend against?
So zero-day threats is developed by a very good group of cyber criminals, and these type of cyber criminals is normally what we call in this case the CLOP group, which is a Russian-speaking cyber criminal syndicate known for its large-scale data theft and extortion campaigns. So the zero day is they are out to write code to exploit a system that you don't know is going to be, obviously, they don't know of the patch, they don't know of what is going to hit, whereas normal cyber attacks is could be known, could be stopped by the systems. And also from a Checkpoint perspective, we say that we've got a what we call a threat cloud AI engine that runs 51 plus AI engines to protect against these zero-day attacks before they hit the customers.
Ian, explain to me why the education sector is so targeted. What's the motive here, do you think?
Well, the fact is the education sector is number one, rapidly transforming digitally. This expands the attack surface and typically underfunded cybersecurity defenses, which make it frequent, which make it open to frequent attacks. Now, ultimately, you know, universities are targeted because they are, number one, I don't want to say easy targets, but there's a lot of data from a student perspective, from a the people perspective, and also the employees inside a university that they want. They want also data regarding, you know, maybe theses that's been written and other related confidential information.
So the real world consequences of an attack like this on student staff and academic operations, as you're saying to me, is really serious and onerous.
Definitely. You know, there is a what we call a treasure trove of sensitive data, including obviously personal information of students, faculty and staff, as well as academic records, researchers, and the intellectual property make it prime targets for cyber criminals, specifically the intellectual property that they want. So these cyber criminals, yes, they sometimes out for money. So they put in what we call ransomware, where they lock data and they say, pay us in Bitcoin to unlock your data. That means they purely after money. But it's not always just about a money thing. It could also be the intellectual property that resides inside that university.
And Ian, the figure I find staggering is this 4,000 weekly attacks per institution, if I've got that right. It tells us a lot, doesn't it, about the scale of the problem?
Correct. I mean, it's a figure of 4,000 plus. It is high. But if you look at some institutions out there in Africa, Africa is one of the most targeted countries in the world when it comes to cyber attacks. And 4,000 plus is not an unusual number or a frightening number, if you can call it like that, from a cyber attack perspective. The financial institutions and some of the other retail stores and so forth get even more attacks than that, and they have to put in security measures to mitigate that.
So if you were advising university leadership today, what action should they take immediately to strengthen their defenses?
Well, number one, they need to what we call install AI-powered threat detection or comprehensive endpoint protection and secure access controls. Remember, cyber criminals don't just come in from the front door. They don't just walk in and say, hi, we're here. They will figure out anywhere. They'll come through the roof of a house. They'll come through the window. They will try anywhere to penetrate that environment. And you need to mitigate that risk from the data center right through to the cloud, right through to the endpoint. Number two, I would say promote cybersecurity awareness among staff and students as a collective approach. They need to understand what cybersecurity is all about and what the threats are. Make sure that software is up to date. You know, patches and upgrades are should be in place. I know Oracle released this patch, and the University of Witwatersrand, they immediately applied the patch, and they worked with Oracle to do this. And from a checkpoint perspective, you know, we have a service whereby we can analyze attacks, trends, and identify institutional vulnerabilities, such as zero-day threats. And it's not just about Checkpoint. It's a collaborative approach where all software vendors plus security vendors need to work together to make this work.
Ian van Rensburg, I'm going to leave it there with my thanks from Checkpoint Software Technologies. I appreciate your time today. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.